I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. Climate scientist Kate Marvel started her career as a cosmologist and says the Earth is the perfect planet to sustain human, animal, and plant life in our awe-inspiring universe. By manipulating climate models, she's been able to peer into the future, and what she sees scares her. We're on a path of global warming that is leading to more ferocious storms, intense fires, rising seas, severe droughts, and record-breaking heat. It also angers and frustrates her because we've known for a long time that human-created greenhouse gases are the main culprit, but our efforts to curtail them have fallen short. After all, 2024 was the hottest year on record. While Marvel depends on scientific data for her work, she's also a human being with an emotional life. She has a new book, Human Nature, 9 Ways to Feel About Our Changing Planet, where she writes about wonder, anger, guilt, fear, grief, surprise, pride, hope, and finally, love. In 2023, she led the Climate Trends chapter in the U.S. government's 5th National Climate Assessment. Kate Marvel, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Are you surprised that this made you so emotional to look around our universe and see the vastness of our universe and then see this tiny little planet orbiting around?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with studying the entire universe, right? Is you realize that pretty much all of it wants to kill you. And when you zoom in onto this little tiny planet kind of orbiting this mediocre garden variety little star, you really start to realize, oh my gosh, this is the greatest place in the universe. It's the only good planet, the only planet that we know of where life can exist. And I thought that was pretty great.
Well, it reminded me how astronauts often describe what it looks like back on the Earth, and they see this beautiful green and blue orb that's just surrounded by almost nothingness, and the kind of awe, sense of awe that they feel looking back down at the Earth.
Absolutely. I mean, can you imagine just being able to take a picture and think, wow, that's everything. That's everything that I care about. That's everything I will ever love and everybody I'll ever love. That is, I cannot imagine what a profound experience that must be.
It's funny to think of a stereotype as of a scientist, as someone who is very data-driven, which clearly scientists like yourself are, but that you don't have an emotional life, that you don't have feelings about what it is that you're discovering.
I know, right? And that's actually kind of why I struggled with writing this book at first, because I had internalized that, right? I was like, scientists are supposed to be objective and neutral, and we are supposed to feel nothing. And that is where our credibility comes from. And then I struggled with that because obviously I did feel things, right? I have a conflict of interest because I live in the place that I study. And then I kind of realized that, oh no, we don't make ourselves more credible when we pretend we don't have any emotions, right? Like that makes us liars. And I don't want to be a liar. So exactly like you said, I love data. I want more data. And I feel like we can get the science right. We can solve the equations. We can write the code. And at the same time, own up to the fact that we are human beings with feelings.
Does that make you a different kind of scientist? One that owns up to those feelings, maybe feels them even more now that they're part of your whole way of life?
I don't know. I don't think it necessarily makes me a different kind of scientist. I think science has always been a human endeavor. It's always been done by human beings. And I think that's one of the really beautiful things about it. It's kind of this gorgeous collective enterprise where we all work together and we find out stuff about the world. So I think, you know, I do not think that I am unique in having feelings and emotions and being a human being as a scientist. I think that's the way it's always been. And when we kind of are able to acknowledge that, then I think we get a more complete picture of how special the scientific enterprise is.
Tell us how perfect the Earth is, and maybe even what a miracle it is, the fact that it is where it is, its distance from the sun, even the tilt of the Earth, all these things had to exactly line up for us to survive on this planet.
I know. It's just, it's absolutely perfect, isn't it? So we are a great distance from our star. We exist in what astronomers call a Goldilocks zone. So not too close, not too far away. But I think the thing that most people don't really appreciate about that is if all we were was a barren rock, just sitting in exactly the same place, we would be well below freezing. Our temperature would be well below freezing. The sun, for all of its power, isn't enough to keep the Earth warm. What keeps us warm, what allows human beings and other life to exist, is greenhouse gases. So naturally occurring carbon dioxide is a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of the atmosphere. It's 280 parts per million. So that's less than a third of a percent. But because carbon dioxide is so powerful at trapping the heat coming from the planet, it's able to raise our temperature from well below freezing to about 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And so for me, that's a really sort of profound realization that we exist only because the sky does. So not only are we in the perfect position, but we kind of live under the perfect kind of sky.
I was thinking of that sky decades ago. I was in East Africa, actually camping out and looking up at the African sky, very different from the sky we see here in Philadelphia, obviously the Southern Hemisphere, but there was nothing. There were no lights around. And to this day, feeling that sense of awe as I looked up into, I don't know how far back I could look, but there it all was.
So I'm preoccupied with being jealous that you had that experience. That sounds incredible. But yeah, I do, you know, don't you think that this is kind of a universal human thing? You see it in kids all the time, but even us kind of jaded, miserable adults, right? Like we look up at the world and there's just occasionally times when, you know, your breath just catches and you think, oh my gosh, I'm so lucky to live here.
Well, even the act of looking up is an act of hope and optimism, don't you think?
I love that way of putting it. Yeah. I mean, it's saying I am one with the universe. I am part of this world. And what a magnificent, incredible universe this is.
You have worked as a cosmologist. You're a climate scientist. I know part of your career has been to use these climate models. I mean, literally, what are you doing and what are you looking for? How far into the future can you go? How far back can you go?
So I am a, I work with climate models, which are basically, you can think of them as toy planets that live on a computer. And you can do experiments on these things that you could never do otherwise. You can make everybody go live on another planet for 500 years while you try to investigate the Earth without human influence. You can kind of spiral us back to the last ice age or the, you know, time of the dinosaurs. And it's underappreciated, I think, how fun it is to work with climate
models. Sounds like fun.
You know, you get to be this kind of malevolent goddess where you can just wave your wand and you can make a volcano go off in London if you want to. You know, you can do these things that bear no resemblance to the world that we live in. And then you can do things that do bear a resemblance to the world that we live in. So I guess like another way of thinking about climate models is that they're very literally world building tools. You know, when you read a book that you really enjoy, even if it takes place in, you know, a sci-fi universe or a fantasy universe or like a world very different from your own, you find it satisfying if there are internal logic, if the rules make sense, right? And that is what a climate model does. Because it runs on physics and math, it can show you worlds that are different from your own, but have really coherent internal rules that you can understand and you can make predictions with. And so that's another way, I think, of thinking about a climate model is, yeah, it's a way of feeding in stories and seeing what happens.
you write that the scientists don't know everything, and that should not come as a shock to anybody. But you do know some things, and some things you have told us about. So we do know that burning fossil fuels essentially is heating the Earth, the planet, creating life-changing things like floods and droughts on planet Earth, and potentially catastrophic effects on human beings. Is that a fair analysis?
I think it is. When we burn fossil fuels, just that process of combustion releases carbon dioxide. That's just what it does. That's the chemical reaction. There's no way to prevent that when you're burning fossil fuels. And we talked earlier about how carbon dioxide was so powerful that even this tiny, tiny amount was able to raise the Earth's temperature to make it livable. And imagine then what happens when you increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by about 50%. That's what we've done, not just by burning fossil fuels, but by clearing forests and raising livestock. Our agricultural practices also contribute to this problem. And so I guess for me, it's the fact that we understand why the Earth has a temperature at all means that we understand why it's changing. And the physics that tell us why there are winds and rainfall, why there are tropics and poles, the physics of that then helps us tell why the planet is changing when it gets hotter, right? So, something that people ask me a lot is, oh, the Earth is almost 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer.
Right.
Who cares, right? That sounds like a tiny amount. And nobody lives in the global average. Nobody experiences that. But what we do experience, like you were reading off this litany of terrible things, right? And we understand, how when the planet gets warmer, that leads to terrible things. We know that when it gets hotter, there's more heat waves. That's pretty straightforward. But we also know that hot air holds more water vapor. And that means that there's more that can be dumped on us in these big downpours. We know that at the same time, hot air is thirstier air, right? Your clothes dry quicker when you leave them out on a hot day than when you leave them out on a cold day. And because that's driving more evaporation from the surface, at the same time, we are seeing higher drought risk. We know that warm water is hurricane food. And so as the seas warm up, that means we're seeing stronger hurricanes. We know that warm water expands and warm ice melts, and that means the sea levels are rising. So there's a lot, I think, that falls out of the physics. So we understand that when the planet gets warmer, all of this stuff starts to happen, and that stuff has major impacts on our way of life.
Let me pick up on that after this very short break. I'm talking with Kate Marvel. She is a climate scientist, and she's got a brand new book. It's called Human Nature, 9 Ways to Feel About Our Changing Planet. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, and again, Kate Marvel is our guest, and she's got a new book called Human Nature, 9 Ways to Feel About Our Changing Planet, former cosmologist, and currently working as a climate scientist. I have a really basic question. You mentioned right before the break that the Earth is basically 1.4 degrees centigrade hotter now than it was before the Industrial Revolution. I had to do my math to get that to Fahrenheit. That's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. And I was thinking, you go outside, it's 65 degrees or it's 68 degrees. You don't really feel the difference. So why that, 1 to 2 degree difference has such a huge impact on our environment?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's something that I think a lot of people struggle with, including me. Honestly, it seems like such a tiny little change. But when you think about it as in terms of energy flows, when you think about the incredible amount of energy that means, energy that's now been trapped in the Earth system, it's no wonder that we start seeing these really, really, really impactful changes. My colleague Catherine Hayhoe refers to it not as global warming, but as global weirding.
Oh,
And I
weirding.
think that is that I think that's a better way to put it. Because I don't care that it's getting hotter on average. What I care about is that that is affecting weather patterns, that's raising sea levels, that's making it harder to grow crops in some places, that is messing with ecosystems and vegetation and forests. So what I care about is the impacts of this large amount of energy that's now been added to the Earth system.
I mean, variability, as you write, is, part of the Earth's history. We've had volcano eruptions, El Nino. I mean, there are all sorts of, I guess, so-called natural things that have happened that has affected our environment. How has what we have done compared to that?
Yeah, I feel like, people love to tell climate scientists that the climate's changed before, and we're like, we know, we told you that. Right? And, it's true that a lot of us are really dedicated to studying past climate changes in Earth's history in order to tell us something about what we're seeing now. But the reason that what we're seeing now is so different is both the magnitude and the speed. We can look in ice cores, and those give us a record of how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere for the past 800,000 years. And so the levels that we're seeing right now are unprecedented in at least 800,000 years and likely more. And if you look at the graph, it kind of wiggles a little bit for hundreds of thousands of years. And all of a sudden, kind of 1850 and beyond, it starts to shoot up.
Wow.
And that's what we're seeing with temperature too. That's what we're seeing with a whole bunch of different aspects of the climate system is they're changing a lot and they're changing really quickly.
Well, speaking about emotions, I mean, how frankly angry, frustrated have you been and other climate scientists have been in that you have been raising the alarm or telling us for many years now. In fact, you describe a woman scientist in the 19th century who was saying, "Hey, folks, there we're talking about a warming planet." But how angry and frustrated are you that the message hasn't, it gets through in bits and pieces, but it hasn't obviously had the kind of impact if 2024 was the hottest year in recorded history?
I'm not going to lie to you. The anger chapter was one of the easiest to
Was
write.
it?
It is.
I
It
have it
is
right here.
a feeling that is very much at the forefront. And I think the thing that makes me the angriest is that, as you said, this stuff is not new science, right? We scientists, we love talking about stuff we don't know. We love talking about kind of the bleeding edge of knowledge. And actually, this is not the bleeding edge of knowledge. It's stuff we've known since the 1800s. And it's very well established. It's very basic. But if you look at the history kind of the discovery of climate change and the recognition that it was a problem by scientists, that is intertwined with the history of people lying about it. And the thing that makes me really mad is they lie about the uncertainty, right? They say, oh, scientists don't know everything, therefore they don't know anything. And like you said, like we know stuff. We know a lot of stuff. And the fact that some things are uncertain, like, yeah, of course they are. That is why I still have a job. If we figure out everything, science is over. And we are so far from figuring out everything. But that doesn't mean that there is not really well-established science. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It comes from burning fossil fuels and makes the earth hotter. When the earth is hotter, stuff gets weird. We know all that. We've known that for a really long time.
You quote, and I do remember this. This was about 10 years ago. Senator Inhofe, I believe of Oklahoma, this was after whatever year that was declared the hottest on record. It's the winter. I think it's February. He's in the Senate and he's holding a snowball, saying, basically saying you guys are lying because you're saying it's the hottest year on record, and yet here I have a snowball. I'm looking at you, Kate. I can see the anger. I mean, is that ignorance or is it just lying? Is it denial? What's going on there?
I think it's, yeah, I don't know. I have to say, I do not enjoy being in the mindset of some of these people. It's not a particularly nice space that I like to occupy. But, you know, I think the accusation that somehow science is unaware of the phenomenon of winter, you know, that's just, that doesn't sit very well with me. And, you know, we get this every year, like, oh, there's a cooling trend between, you know, September and December, like, checkmate, nerds. And, you know, it happens every year, and it's tiresome. It can be very tiresome to debunk stuff. What I will say, and what does surprise me, and I think surprises a lot of people, is that if you look at the polling, the Yale Center on Climate Change Communication does this great polling work where they ask Americans how they feel about climate change. And they call their study the Six Americas because people roughly fall into one of six buckets, ranging from alarmed about climate change to concerned, all the way to kind of dismissives. And in that hardcore dismissive denial group, that is single digits. That's about 7% of Americans. And so I feel like, okay, there's those people who, for whatever reason, and I'm not sure I really care, you know, are resistant to evidence, don't want to hear anything. But the vast majority of people are either already there, already alarmed, or, you know, amenable to hearing more about it. And the thing that really stands out in the polling is that most people think that they are the only one. People do not realize how widespread concern about climate change and support for climate action is. And that's kind of why I feel that maybe the best thing that we can do about climate change is to actually talk to each other about it.
Your book takes me back to the 1960s and 70s. I'm a bit older than you, but I remember life before the EPA, life before the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and what things were like here. There was smog, there was, you know, CFC, there were all sorts of things that were going on. And I remember a summer here in Philly in 1970 where it felt like the sky, I never saw the blue sky. It was just this hazy thing that hung over the city. But you could smell it, you could see it, you could even taste it. And I wonder whether that was one of the reasons that they were at least, or Nixon was able to at least get some of these environmental regulations put into place.
Yeah, I think, you know, I will talk about the Clean Air Act all the time. I'm obsessed with the Clean Air Act because it was a miracle. It has saved millions of lives. It has made hundreds of millions of lives better. You know, our rivers don't catch on fire. Our skies are not, you know, black with pollution all the time, although they are now orange with wildfire smoke, but that's another story. The fact that we were able to do this, we were able as a society to do this. You know, I'm not a political scientist. I am not a social scientist. And that's because I like studying things that behave themselves. I'm a physicist because water droplets and parcels of air, they always do the right thing when you push them, right? They just act like the laws of physics tell them to. People are complex. People are incredibly difficult to understand. And that's why we are interesting. You know, if you ask, well, what led to the Clean Air Act? It was a confluence of so many different things, right? You know, people looking up at the sky and thinking, I am sick of this and I don't want to live like this. Mass action, right? The Clean Air Act came after the first Earth Day gathering, which I think up until the 2020 protest was the largest protest in American history.
That was 1970, yeah.
You know, it was a culmination of a lot of scientific research, a lot of research both establishing that, oh my gosh, this is really unhealthy, but also technological research into here's how you do the stuff that you need to do without emitting air pollution. And so it is never just one thing, right? It's always, you know, slowly, slowly, and then all at once. And it's always influenced by so many different people doing so many different things.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kate Marvel, our guest today on The Connection. She's a climate scientist, and she's got a new book called Human Nature: 9 Ways to Feel About Our Changing Planet. Well, there were, as a result of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the EPA, some dramatic changes in our environment. Not perfect. Obviously, there have been longstanding problems associated with that kind of pollution. But here we are now with the Trump administration basically dismantling the EPA, undoing support for renewable energy, wanting to bring back big coal. So maybe one step forward, but it feels like three steps back or more.
Yeah, I think, so there's good news and bad news here. So I'll start with the bad news, or I guess I don't have to. You've already laid it out.
There it is.
Which is that, it appears like right now the U.S. as a country is sort of opting out of the energy transition, of the renewable energy revolution. But the good news is that climate change is a global problem. A molecule of CO2 emitted anywhere affects everywhere. And if you look at global trends, the switch to renewable and low carbon forms of energy is really well underway. If you had told me even 10 years ago that, wind and solar will be the cheapest ways of generating electricity in history, I'm not sure I would have believed you. If you look at how the prices of these things have come down, how the price of battery storage has come down, it used to be that, solar is great, but sometimes the sun doesn't shine, and wind is great, but sometimes the wind doesn't blow. And now we've got storage. And the technological progress, but also the progress made in, local government, in state governments, in thinking about what are interesting policy experiments we could try. I think that is very exciting. And so I'm not sugarcoating the fact that the U.S. does appear to have abdicated leadership in the 21st century economy. I think that's bad for reasons beyond climate change, but that doesn't mean that this transition is not happening globally.
But do you think in the United States that the progress made on renewables, for instance, can be undone by this administration, or are we sort of too far into it? I mean, I think Texas gets, most of its power from wind, for instance.
Texas leads the nation in wind power. And that's not because everybody in Texas is a hippie who just loves renewable energy. It's because it's cheap. It's reliable. And I think I wouldn't go so far as to say things are unstoppable. Because, there's still a lot of harm that can be done. And B, because I have learned my lesson over the last 10 years or so in American politics. Like, I don't make predictions. I don't know what I'm talking about. But I think globally, the trends are pointing in the right direction. Not quickly enough, but they are going in the right direction.
I wonder, too, and that can feel very scary, to be living with all these storms and the droughts and the rising sea level. I mean, those things are happening. It's different from smog, but nonetheless, they're happening, and they're happening all over the world and happening in many cases in our own backyard. And I was thinking about fear. I mean, when we're afraid, we can fight, we can take flight, we can freeze. One of the things that you say you're concerned about, that when we're afraid, we can turn on each other rather than kind of come together and figure out how to solve a problem.
Yeah, that is actually my greatest fear.
Is it?
And this was kind of an obvious, but for me, very striking revelation that, we talked about climate models, right? I destroy the planet all the time at work. And it happens on a computer, and then you pause the simulation and then you go home. And it was a massive realization for me to realize that, oh my gosh, climate change is not just happening in a computer model. It's happening in the real world. It's happening to us, and it's happening in the world that we've built for it. So climate change is not this kind of sterile problem happening on a computer that you can type in a couple of equations and optimize it and have the best solution kind of come out. It is happening to us, and we are a mess. It is blasting apart those fissures in society. It's magnifying inequalities. And, there's this notion that, we'll just adapt. And there's no just about it, right? Adaptation is a complicated, messy process, deciding who gets what, who goes where. And I just worry, well, I know that we do not have the capacity as a messy human society to face this adversity in the healthiest and most productive possible way.
I think it's very easy, myself included. I feel this way. You do your small part. Use cloth bags instead of plastic bags. You recycle, keep the heat down, blah, 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 all those things that we're supposed to do. And yet that feels like such a drop in the bucket when you're talking, when you look around the planet and you see rising sea levels and glaciers disappearing. I mean, it just feels like it's not enough.
It does, doesn't it? And I'm so frustrated by that. But what I do think is that we tend to make this sort of false dichotomy where we say either you need to get to zero carbon dioxide in your own personal life, or you need to be the president of the United States. And there is nothing that you can do in between that. And I agree that individual action feels very frustrating. And it feels like it doesn't do anything. And that's because it kind of doesn't do anything, right? This is a huge global problem, and nobody cares if Kate Marvel, reduces her carbon footprint. Like, the atmosphere doesn't care where the carbon comes from. But none of us is an individual. We are all connected to each other. We are all connected to our communities through school communities and faith communities and our workplaces. And so I think there is so much that we can do as individuals to not be individuals anymore. I think if you have a job, even if your job doesn't have sustainability in the title, like, do you have a job? Is it on Earth? Congratulations, you have a climate job. And there's ways that you can think about using your skills and your talents and your passions to reduce emissions in the way that is unique to you.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. And again, Kate Marvel is our guest today on The Connection. She's a climate scientist, and she's got a new book we've been talking about. It's titled Human Nature: 9 Ways to Feel About Our Changing Planet. And as we all know, living on this planet, it is indeed changing, but all is not lost. Do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back in 1 minute.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with climate scientist Kate Marvel. Back in 2023, she led the climate trends chapter in the U.S. government's 5th National Climate Assessment. And again, we are talking about her new book. It's called Human Nature. The show is called The Connection. So anytime anyone says the word connection, my ear goes up. And you talked about, the fact, and you write about the fact that as a cosmologist looking around the universe or looking around our planet Earth as a climate scientist, everything is connected. Maybe human beings are not necessarily connected the way everything in the Earth is connected together.
Yeah, I think we're kind of bound together by the fact that we all have to obey the laws of physics, right? If we manage to go colonize Mars or find some other planet, first of all, that planet will be garbage. We will not enjoy it there. But also, the laws of physics are still going to apply there. If we mess up Earth, what is to stop us messing up that other planet? But I think the fact that this is a living planet and it is a beautiful, intertwined living planet is really important, right? Because carbon dioxide and carbon cycle through our planet, where naturally it goes in the atmosphere and then it is taken out by plants that use it to photosynthesize, that make their own food out of sunlight. for me, that's basically magic. And the weather patterns on Earth, the climate of the Earth is shaped by the things that live on the Earth. So, you know, for example, in England, England has a pretty warm and mild climate. And part of that is because it's an island and, you know, coastal climates tend to be more mild. But part of it is because of the Rocky Mountains. So as air flows over the Rocky Mountains and the earth turns, it kind of sets up this big wave pattern. And it means that air goes over the Rockies, goes south, and then comes up to Europe, bringing warm air from warmer latitudes. And for me, there's something so beautiful about that. There's something so beautiful about understanding the unexpected connections between everything on the earth.
You mentioned before the break about what people can or maybe can't do. And one of the things that you say in this book is, yes, we should focus on tailpipe emissions and emissions from power plants, but it's really how we eat, what we have done to the land in order to grow our food or to graze crops. That's had maybe the biggest impact on climate change or climate weirdness than almost anything else.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily had the biggest impact, but I think it's had the most underappreciated impact. Most people think that climate change is just about burning fossil fuels, and it is largely about burning fossil fuels, but it is our land use choices, both what we do with land and what we eat, that are kind of an underappreciated contributor to the problem. For a shorthand for what's causing climate change is basically fossil fuels and cows.
And cows.
The fact that we clear land, so we take forests, which are very good at taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and replace them with pastures, which are not. And then we raise cattle on those pastures, and cattle burp out methane. Methane is shorter lived in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide sticks around for hundreds, even thousands of years. Methane gets flushed out after about a decade. But while it's up there, it is more than 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide.
Wow.
And cows are a huge source of methane.
You talked about what people can do, and I'm assuming, just picking up on that, you know, either don't eat meat or eat a lot less meat. I assume that would probably be helpful for the environment. Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, shifting to more plant-based diets is helpful. I understand how emotional food is, right? I'm a home cook. I love cooking. My mom was the world's greatest cook. And so I have a real emotional attachment to food. So I would never tell anybody what to eat. But at the same time, there are ways that we can incorporate more plants into our diet in ways that maybe we don't even miss the meat. And so I'm not saying don't ever eat meat. But what I am saying is that maybe only eat good meat. Huh. Maybe only be thoughtful about the meat that you're eating and make sure it tastes real good. And otherwise, you know, experiment with plant-based recipes.
These are more global questions, but in terms of cutting carbon emissions, and you touch on this in the book, there's the option of seeding clouds, even feeding antacids to the oceans, which have become acidified, scattering rock dust. Are these all sort of within the realm of possibility? I assume whatever you do, there's the effect, and then there's the counter effect as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, we are all of these things, I think I would put under the basic umbrella of geoengineering. And the thing I am freaked out about all of these things. I think it's natural to freak out about these things. But I do remember that no geoengineering, so no human induced change to the planet, that's not an option anymore. And so geoengineering basically falls into two basic categories. So we could either try to cool down the planet by blocking the sun. So that's where cloud seeding would fit in. That's where spraying particles into the stratosphere to try to block the sun, that would fall under that. And then there's ways to try to hack that carbon cycle, to try to get the planet to take more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And that's where you've got things like dumping antacid into the oceans, which will make them take up more, right? What could go wrong?
Right, exactly.
Take up more
what
carbon
about the
dioxide
fish?
From the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Electroshock therapy for the ocean to kind of literally shock it into taking up more carbon dioxide. So these are areas of active research. There's a lot of really smart people looking into these things as kind of like a Hail Mary. But all of the smart, thoughtful people working on carbon dioxide removal understand that, look, this stuff is only going to work if we stop emitting the stuff in the first place, right? The way I see it is it's kind of like having your stomach pumped, right? You want that to be an option if you need it, but honestly, you should really stop eating poison.
And that's fossil fuels. I mean, that's the poison, right?
It is, yeah.
I mean, it is that and I guess cows and methane, but fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I welcome any opportunity to say mean things about fossil fuels. I mean,
bring it on.
what they really are is they're solar energy, but stupid. The reason fossil fuels give us energy is hundreds of millions of years ago, some plant somewhere did photosynthesis, took carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in order to make its own food, to give it energy. Now, that plant had energy. Maybe somebody came along and ate that plant. And then when the plant or the animal died, they still had kind of their last meal, that last energy trapped in their body. And so fast forward, you know, hundreds of millions of years, we then dig that up and combustion is liberating that hundreds of millions of years old solar energy. So I think we have a choice now. We can either harness solar energy by having a plant photosynthesize and then waiting hundreds of millions of years, or we could use the direct sunlight to just move electrons around. And that's what a solar panel will do.
We're rather close to the New Jersey shore, a very favorite spot for people living in this part of the world to go down the shore, as we say, to enjoy the barrier islands and the beaches there. New Jersey apparently is sinking, or that part of New Jersey is sinking. And of course, we got sea level rise. And I remember hearing someone say, with this sort of managed retreat idea, like, what do you do? How tall can those stilts be on your house in order to enjoy the beach? That at some point, the ocean's going to win, but that it's going to be the insurance companies that instead of, you know, federal policy or even state policy, the insurance companies are going to be the ones that drive people from the beach because things will be uninsurable or be so expensive you cannot afford to insure your house.
Yeah, I think we are staring down the barrel of a massive financial crisis when we look at the collapse of insurance. Interestingly enough, that's actually the thing that convinced my dad about the reality of climate change.
Really?
So yeah, my dad is, he's a self-identified conservative. He feels, you know, he believes in the free market. And his daughter, being a climate scientist and telling him this stuff was real, was not enough to convince him. But what was enough to convince him was that every single insurance company, especially the reinsurance companies, which are the insurance companies for the insurance companies, they've got climate scientists on staff.
Wow.
They are pricing in climate risk. And if it wasn't real, somebody could come along and offer lower rates and put everybody out of business. And they're not doing that, which means that it is real. So that was the argument that convinced him, that kind of made him see that this was a real thing.
Right. Not his daughter, the climate scientist.
Yeah. I love you, Dad, if you're listening.
Fair enough. Let me ask you about you, Kate, because at the last chapter is called Love, and you talk about your family that you love, who you love, I should say, and your two kids. A couple of years ago, you were diagnosed, I guess, with some kind of a brain clot in your brain as you write about it. Just sort of happened suddenly. You had all sorts of symptoms. What did happen? What was going on with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's still very uncertain, something we don't really know what's happening. But I had a blood clot in my brain, and then it was unclear what had caused that. I got very lucky. I would have died had it not been caught at exactly the time it was caught.
Wow.
And as a result, I kind of live in this charmed existence now, right? All of this is bonus life. I'm not supposed to be here. I am completely unnatural, and I do wake up every day kind of with the sense that I'm getting away with something. And that can be a really good feeling.
Indeed. Well, I mean, what were your symptoms? How did you or other people know what was going on with you?
Just a mysterious headache, and then an elevated blood test that revealed something, and then was rushed to the hospital, put on blood thinners, and that seemed to be it. But then went in, the clot wasn't completely gone. They found a tumor in my brain,
Wow.
which is never something you want to hear.
Nope.
But the tumor seems to be hanging out, behaving itself right now. But the reason that I wanted to write about that is A, to sort of try to humanize myself and say, I'm a scientist, but I'm a human being, but also to kind of explore this sense of connection, right? I love nature writing. I love John Muir. I love, Wordsworth. I love this sense of connecting with the sublime. But I found that some of the nature writing, which was saying, "Oh, nature's great because there's no people in it," that didn't resonate with me anymore. And I didn't necessarily just want to be natural because I am unnatural. It's human intervention that saved me. It's human interventions that kept me alive. And what I realized is, oh wow, I'm going to constantly have to be rethinking and renegotiating my relationship with the planet and the world. And that's how it is. That's what happens in every single relationship that's meaningful.
Well, I love, frankly, the way you write about all this, and you say you walk through the world in a state of overwhelming grace,
I do.
because I mean, you're living with sort of an uncertain diagnosis, but waking up every day and there's the world again, right?
Yeah, it makes me very annoying, I think. It's kind of
Really?
an
How so?
unearned
Oh, to
optimism.
Right, who wants to live with an optimist? But it's funny, you gave your blood clot a name. You called him Mitch. Why Mitch?
I apologize to all of the nice Mitches out there, but I've never met one.
You've never met these Mitches. That's pretty funny. But do you feel more mortal? Do you feel more mortal?
I definitely do. I spent my entire youth, I think the way that most people spend their youth, just assuming that they'll live forever. Intellectually that you won't. Obviously, that someday you're going to die, but it doesn't really feel real. And that kind of for me mirrored the way that I felt about climate change for a long time, where intellectually I knew it was happening. Intellectually, I knew the planet was changing, but it hadn't really sunk in. I didn't really feel that much about it. And when I started to really feel it is when I had a kid. And looking at these projections for this is what the planet will look like by the middle of the 21st century, that was really abstract for me until I realized, oh my gosh, that's his adult years, right? And that made it really concrete. That made it really real. And that made me feel something about it that I hadn't felt before.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye. I mean, thinking of the future, and if we do the worst, which is do something which I'm assuming the Earth will be here. We just won't be here anymore. That it's us then that's endangered as much as the planet. It may not look the way it is now, but it will be here. We won't be.
Yeah, there'll be a rock somewhere in space. It'll continue. And I actually don't think climate change will make human beings go extinct, but I want so much better than not extinct. I think we should raise our standards. And I think we can,
Extinction cannot be the goal, right? Exactly.
Exactly. If there's a couple human beings left on Earth after all this, I won't view that as a victory. I want things to get better. I don't just want to not eliminate all of our species. And I think we can.
Yeah. You do. I was going to say we're almost out of time, but you do feel optimistic? I mean, you feel like we can do this?
I feel like we can do this. Will we? I think we have to decide to do it.
And it's that simple. It's like, let's do it. Mm-hmm. Well, Kate Marvel, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. Thanks for writing this book as well. I learned a lot and I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
You too. Again, Kate Marvel's book is called Human Nature, 9 Ways to Feel About Our Changing Planet. And she is a climate scientist, was a cosmologist. I almost said cosmetologist. She was a cosmologist. And she actually led the climate trends chapter in the U.S. government's 5th National Climate Assessment. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection, the show produced by Debbie Bilder with Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.